Here we are in chapter 2. Chapter 2 is on choices. And what is the economic problem? The economic problem is that we live in a world of scarce resources, and yet people have unlimited wants and needs. So how do we meet their needs in this world of scarcity? Now, when you have scarcity, when there's not enough of so much to go around for everyone who wants it for free, then we have to make choices, right? We have to either choose this or choose that. And that's what this that's how this chapter fits into the economic problem. Scarcity necessitates choices, you know, the necessity of making choices. There's two types of economics. There's positive economics and normative economics. Positive economics is the way things are. Normative economics is the way things ought to be. So a lot of our choices is really part of the normative field. For example, should we have ethanol and gasoline? Well, see, that would be a normative choice. Now, I'm not going to say whether that, you know, yes or no. Or interest rates. You know, should the market determine interest rates? Or should the Federal Reserve determine interest rates? See, choices. You can't have both. We can't have the free market determine interest rates and the Federal Reserve to set interest rates at the same time. See? So we have to, as a society, we have to make a choice, one or the other. It's like, you know, with the ethanol and gasoline, either we have all gasoline or we put some ethanol in it. Well, that's a choice that we, you know, make, you know, as society. Coal, you know, should we burn coal or should we eliminate the coal industry? Right now, the coal industry is being decimated because, you know, coal is, by the government, is considered not a good energy source. And so, you know, many coal companies, through the government regulations, are going out of business. Well, see, that's a choice. I mean, you know, should we burn coal or should we not burn coal? Or at least greatly limit the burning of coal. Again, just choices. The Constitution is, we're going to talk about the Constitution, but this gets down to a command economy versus a democracy. I mean, should, you know, the point here is that, you know, should decisions be made by a central authority or should decisions be made more by the people? See, what does the Constitution do? We're going to talk about this later, but what the Constitution does is that it separates the seats of power. What the Constitution says, it says, you know, the president has these powers, the House of Representatives has these powers, the Senate has these powers, the states has these powers. See, what is the biggest threat to our freedom? The biggest threat to our freedom is centralized power. So what our Constitution does is that it decentralizes power. The whole point of a Constitution is that, is that as long as power becomes decentralized, you know, a little bit is here, a little bit is there, a little bit up here, as long as we decentralize the power base, then we can maintain our personal freedom. But once you concentrate power, then who's ever in the seat of power can do, you know, whatever they want. So, but again, that's a choice that society has to make. You know, do we want a government that has dictatorial type power, or do we want decisions to be made more by the free market? That's a big decision. In fact, this election coming up is pretty much along those lines. I mean, you know, we're going to find out what this country wants. Does this country want a more of a decentralized system, you know, by the Constitution, or do we want a system that is more centrally controlled? And I'm not even saying one choice is good or bad. Safety is something of a choice. I mean, should we arrange our economic affairs to eliminate risk? Okay, what is absolute advantage? Now, before we really get into discussing of certain topics, we have to look at certain concepts. Absolute advantage, the ability to produce something with fewer resources than other producers use. Now, here's the point. What we're talking about here is making choices, correct? Making choices. Should a country produce those things that it is best at producing? Now, on the surface, you would say, well, most people would say, well, sure, I mean, a country should produce things that they are best at producing. But that would be incorrect. That's a false statement. A country, in order to maximize welfare, a country doesn't necessarily want to produce those things that it is best at producing. So what I'm going to show you here is how we use the concepts of absolute advantage and comparative advantage to make decisions, to make choices. Now, let me give you an example. Let's suppose that America was better than anyone else making handmade wicker baskets. I mean, for some reason, Americans just had the knack of making handmade wicker baskets. So does that mean that we ought to spend our time and energy making wicker baskets? But if we did that, what would be our opportunity cost? Now, remember, from the introduction, we talked about some of these concepts. What is opportunity cost? Opportunity cost is that which you give up in the best alternative endeavor for doing what you're doing. Now, you can underline that word best. That which you give up in the best alternative decision to do what you're now doing. So if we were to devote our time and energy making handmade wicker baskets, what would be our opportunity cost? When I say we, I'm talking about America. I'm talking about an advanced, industrialized country with a high level of education. And so if we, for every hour we would spend making a handmade wicker basket, that's an hour that we could not spend somewhere in the high-tech field. Now, what do you think would be more profitable for America, to spend an hour in the high-tech field or an hour with someone making a handmade wicker basket? I mean, which would yield the greatest return in the market?
The tech field?
Yeah, the tech field, obviously, correct?
Yeah.
So, see, my original question was, should America produce, or any country, should any country produce those things that it is best at producing?
No.
The answer is no. Why? Because we don't want to produce things that we have an absolute advantage in necessarily. See? An absolute advantage says, hey, we can do this better than anyone else. Comparative advantage says, we can do this with lower opportunity costs than someone else. Okay? And if you want, when you, if you want to max, if a country wants to maximize its welfare, or if you want to maximize your welfare, you've got to learn to make decisions not based on your absolute advantage, but based on your comparative advantage. You want to do those things where you have low opportunity costs. See, let me give you another example. Yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, what about, like, harming the environment? I mean, like, where does that play a role?
Well, harming the environment, that's another... Oh, yeah, okay. Now, what we're talking about here is choices, correct?
Yeah.
So when you're talking about harming the environment, that would be another element, something that we would consider when we make choices, see? So what I'm talking about here is that one of those tools, in order for us to make good decisions, is knowing the difference between absolute advantage and comparative advantage. And that's not to say that these are the only reasons that we would make decisions, right? There are other, like you say, there might be environmental factors. But I'm not talking about those other factors. You know, I'm just talking about the concept of comparative advantage versus absolute advantage. You see, for example, let's say that your room needs painting. And let's just say that... you're a professional. Now, how much does a professional make in the New River Valley per hour? Anybody know? The average wage for a professional in New River Valley is about $50 an hour. Okay, so, you know, when you graduate and you become a professional, then you know you could expect to make about $50 an hour. That's the going, you know, the going rate. I mean, if you go to a lawyer, you go to an accountant, you know, people like that, it's about $50 an hour. So let's say that you're a professional, you can make $50 an hour, but you can hire someone to paint your room for $20 an hour. Now, if you paint the room, and I'm assuming here that the hour that you spend painting the room is an hour that you don't, let's say you're a lawyer. So that's an hour that you don't spend, you know, making $50 an hour. So if you paint the room yourself, what's your opportunity cost?
Not making $50 an hour.
Not making $50 an hour. That's well put. Okay? So you lose $50. So what should you do? Well, yeah, get someone to paint the room. You hire someone.
It's more valuable.
Yeah, time is valuable. You hire someone, you pay them $20, the room gets painted, you pay them $20, you make $50, so you're ahead $30, correct? Now, that decision, that choice that you made because you had a comparative advantage, you see, in practicing law. You didn't have a comparative advantage in painting the room. Even though you may have had an absolute advantage in painting the room. Maybe you can paint the room better than anyone else. All right? But we're not talking about that. What we're talking about is dollars and cents in a more concrete. What we're saying is that if you hire someone to paint the room, you're ahead $30. Now, let's say that you're not a professional and you can only make $10 an hour. But to hire someone to paint the room, you got to pay them $20 an hour. Now, should you paint the room yourself or hire somebody?
I would still hire someone because it's easy.
Well,
no,
dollars and cents now, though.
Like,
all right. If you can only make $10 an hour and you got to pay someone $20 an hour, right? Then you're losing $10 an hour if you hire someone, correct? So. In terms of dollars and cents, this is very concrete. This is not a philosophy course.
Well, can you use that time to actually invest in something else?
Well, we're not, you know, don't. You're only caring. What I'm saying is that in that hour, you can only make $10. I'm assuming here that in that hour, you can only make $10. And I'm also assuming that you've got to pay someone $20 to paint the room. So the decision that you should make is paint the room yourself and don't hire somebody. Why? Because you don't have a comparative advantage in painting the room. All right? Well, actually, I'm sorry, you do have a comparative advantage in painting the room. So so you would actually paint the room yourself. The only point I'm making here is that I'm introducing to you an economic principle. See, now what's the name of this course? The Principles of Economics, correct? And one of those principles is understanding the difference between absolute advantage and comparative advantage, and the knowledge that good decisions in terms of dollars and cents are made via comparative advantage, not absolute advantage. Countries should produce those things that they have a comparative advantage in, all right? Economists always make decisions based on opportunity cost. You know, if we do this instead of that, what is our opportunity cost? The big picture, is it cheaper for a company to move to Mexico and pay a worker $2 an hour or stay in America and pay $20 an hour? Which is cheaper? Well, you might look at it and say, well, obviously it's cheaper to go to Mexico. But that may not be true. Maybe it's much more expensive to go to Mexico. How come? Well, if I say you pay a Mexican worker $2 an hour and an American worker $20 an hour, I'm only giving you half the story. What's the other half the story? Well, yeah, it's what you get back, right? There's inputs and there's output. I mean, when you pay someone, that's an input. But what you get back is the output. So your profit is the difference between input and output. See, for example, let's say that you go to Mexico and you pay someone $2 an hour because Mexico, I'm just assuming here, I'm going to say that Mexico isn't as advanced as we are in terms of technology. They don't have the labor-saving, newest machines. I'm going to assume, this may be a false assumption, but I'm going to assume that maybe the education level isn't high, the skill level, the technical skill level isn't as high. Maybe the communication network in Mexico isn't as what it is in America, in terms of electronics and maybe physical transportation in terms of, roads and things like that. See what makes an American worker productive, more productive than perhaps a Mexican worker? Is it that the American worker, works harder than the Mexican worker? Well, I mean, every Mexican I've ever met is, very hardworking, very efficient worker. So it's not how hard a worker works, but it's what the worker has to work with. See, if the Mexican worker, you pay him $2 an hour, but because of all these things I talked about, maybe the Mexican worker can produce something in an hour that has a market value of $4. So you pay him $2, and you get back $4. So that's 100% increase, correct? You pay him it's a 2-to-1 ratio, so he can produce something that has a market value of $4. Now you pay an American worker $20 an hour, but because of the infrastructure that and all these other factors that the American worker works in, maybe the American worker can produce something in an hour that has a market value of $100. So for every $1 that you pay the American worker, you get $5 back. Now, would you rather pay a Mexican worker $1 and get $2 back, or would you rather pay an American worker $1 and get $5 back? Which is cheaper on a per unit basis? The American worker is cheaper on a per unit basis, even though you're paying them $20 compared to $2 to the Mexican worker. See, decisions, choices. So you've got to see the bigger picture in order to make good decisions, in order to make the right choices. Okay? You've got to see the bigger picture. That's why I call this slide the big picture. See, who are decision makers? The decision makers in our economy are consumers, investors, foreign, and government. Now, everyone who spends money has got to fall into one of these four categories. In fact, these four categories make up what we put into measuring gross domestic product. Gross domestic product is the dollar value of all new and final goods and services produced in the country in any one year. So in order to measure growth, which is the next chapter, but in order to measure growth, what we say is, okay, how much have consumers spent on new and final goods and services? How much have investors spent on new and final goods and services? How much have foreigners spent on new and final goods and services? And for the government, are exports greater than or less than imports? If exports are greater than imports, we got more money coming in than going out. That's an addition to GDP. If exports are less than imports, we got more money going out than coming in, so that'd be a subtraction from GDP. But anyway, these are the four decision makers. So what are the characteristics of these four sectors? Well, a characteristic of the consumption sector, first of all, the consumption sector is the largest sector of GDP. Gross domestic product, but not by a lot. Our government has gotten so big that that it's almost as big as the consumption sector. But the consumption sector is still the largest sector of GDP, And the another characteristic of the consumption sector is that it is very stable, because people are habitual and reluctant to give up what they have been accustomed to. You see, we used to think that if someone's income goes down, let's say someone's making $100,000 a year, but that someone loses their job, but they find another job paying them $60,000 a year. Now, we used to think, okay, now this person that is making $60,000 a year is going to, their spending habits are going to be like someone who's making $60,000 a year. But is that true? No, it's not true. Why is it not true? Well, because people are very reluctant to give up what they've been accustomed to. Like, take this person. Okay, he's making $100,000 a year. Loses his job. Okay, now he's making $60,000 a year. But this person is going to do what he can for as long as he can to maintain his previous lifestyle. How is he going to do that? Well, lots of ways. For one thing, this person may practice what we call dis-saving. See, when we put money into savings, that's called savings. When we take money out of savings, that's called dis-saving. So what this person's going to do is, maybe this person's got money in the bank. You know, maybe he's got $50,000 or so in the bank. So he's going to slowly take money out in order to, you know, pay his mortgage and so he can keep the house and pay his car payment, so he can keep his car and things like that. Now, once he runs out of his savings, then he may dip into what is called real savings. Now, what real savings is things that a person might have that has a market value. Like, maybe you've got a boat that has a market value of $5,000. Or maybe you've got some land that you're not using that has a market value of $25,000. So what this person is going to do at some point is that they're going to sell their boat. They're going to sell their land. All right? But then, let's say that money's gone. You know, you sell your boat, okay, that money's gone. You sell your land, okay, that money's gone. Now what's this person going to do? Well, what this person's now going to do is borrow other people's savings. You know, they might take out a loan from the bank or put more on their credit cards, all right, in order to, you know, maintain their previous lifestyle. But if this person continues to make $60,000 a year, eventually, what's this person going to have to do? Yeah, eventually this person is going to have to change and their habits and, maybe sell the house and move in a smaller house, maybe sell the car and buy a less expensive car. I mean, see, and maybe after 3 or 4 years, now this person, you know, let's say, assuming that he continues to make $60,000 a year, now, after all several years, now he's living and consuming like a person that's making $60,000 a year. See what I mean? But that change came about slowly. See, his income changed overnight, but his spending habits came about slowly. Now, the same thing happens upward, by the way, but it maybe the adjustment upward is quicker than downward. Like, you know, if a person is making $60,000 a year, but they get a raise to $100,000 a year, well, their spending habits aren't going to immediately be like someone that makes $100,000 a year. Why? Because they're, you know, we all seek what is familiar to us, right? I mean, if this person has been used to driving Chevy cars, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with a Chevy, but maybe a BMW is a little nicer drive, he gets a raise, and maybe eventually he learns that, hey, there are things I can do with this extra money that's a lot more fun than the way I used to do things. But there's an adjustment process here, all right? So incomes can change, it's interesting. They did a study once, and learned that if let's take a box of cereal, for example. They learned that if you sell cereal in a rectangle box that has a ratio of 2 to 1, you'll sell more cereal than if you put it in a square box. I mean, if you had breakfast cereals, and you know, assuming that they're all the same, but you know, some were in square boxes and some were in a rectangle box, 9 out of 10 people will choose the rectangle. Why? Because in nature, the 2 to 1 ratio is so common. Your hand is twice as long as it is wide. Your head is twice as long as it is wide. That door is twice as long as it is wide. In nature, the 2 to 1 ratio is dominant. And so that's what people unconsciously are familiar with. So when they're presented with a square box and a rectangle box with a 2 to 1 ratio, 9 out of 10 will buy the rectangle because unconsciously they are drawn toward that which is familiar. All right? So again, we're talking about choices. You know, choices. I mean, see, what I'm saying is to you is that will a $100,000 a year person have certain characteristics and a $60,000 a year person have different characteristics? Well, maybe yes and maybe no. Because it's not that simple. Okay, so what is the characteristic of the investment sector? The investment sector, unlike the consumption sector, is very volatile. See, the point I made with the consumption sector is that it is very slow to change. Change can take place. All kinds of change can take place. People's incomes and, you know, job opportunities and, you know, things can change. But consumers change very slowly. But investors, on the other hand, are change very quickly. The investment sector is very unstable. Why? Because investors make decisions based on their expectations of the future compared with their anticipated costs. See, an investor will make a decision if they believe, considering their costs and everything, that they're going to make a good return on the investment. But no one can foretell the future for sure, you see. So the decision that an investor will make is based on expectations. Now, the reason why the investment sector is so volatile is because expectations can change so quickly. I mean, you know, someone can be very optimistic, and then in the morning they wake up and they read the headlines in the newspaper and they see that, you know, stock prices have gone down, you know, so X percent, and overnight, you know, they turn from being optimistic to pessimistic. And now because they've got, you know, some doubt and fear about the future, well, that determines their investment decisions. And sometimes there's a good reason for these decisions to be one way or the other way, and sometimes there's not such a good reason. In other words, rumors can affect people's decision making, or news, you know, propaganda, you know, can change people's expectations. Even false propaganda can change people's expectations, you know. That's what, you know, dictators have learned, you know, in the past, that if you keep telling people one thing, even though it's a lie, eventually they're going to believe it. So, you know, you can change people's expectations through propaganda. Anyway, so that's the investment sector. It's very volatile because it's based on expectations. You know, it's interesting. You know, let's say that I were to spread a rumor that we were going to have a shortage of sugar. Now, even though that's a rumor, what would a lot of people do?
Stock up on sugar.
Stock up on sugar. So, well, let me say this. Let me backtrack. All right. If we expect a shortage, and even though it's false, you know, but people believe it's not really true, but they believe it's true. If they expect a shortage, then they will buy more now than they normally would, and so what results? A shortage. Well, why do we have a shortage? Because people expected us to have a shortage. See, whatever, generally speaking, whatever we expect to happen, happens. If we expect a shortage, we get a shortage. If enough people expected the prices of houses to go up, even though their expectations were based on, you know, false information, but they expected the prices to go up, then more people, see, not everyone is in the market to buy a house. The people that are in the market to buy a house are those people who are looking to buy a house. And if they can find a house that they like at the price they want to buy, then they will buy it. So those people that are in the market are those who are looking, who are interested in buying. All right? Now, if people expect the price of houses to go up, what will a lot of these people do? Well, a lot of them will say, well, we better buy now before the price goes up, even though we can't find our dream house right away, even though we may not have as much down payment as we would like. But if we don't buy now, we may be forever priced out of the market because price of houses are going up. So with more people buying now instead of waiting, there's greater competition. You know, the demand for houses goes up. And what happens to the price of houses? It goes up. Well, why did the price of houses to go up? Because people expected the price of houses to go up. See, if we expect higher prices, we get higher prices. If we expect shortages, we get shortages. It all becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Interesting part of economics. All right, the foreign sector. What is the characteristic of the foreign sector? The foreign sector can add to the economy if exports are greater than imports, or subtract if imports are greater than exports. So when you're talking about growth, you follow the money. When more money comes into the country than leaves, then we experience growth. We say, well, the country is becoming richer, and we have more demand and more growth. If more, it's just like a family. You know, it's just like you. I mean, if you earn more than you spend week after week, what happens to your wealth, your assets? It goes up, right? I mean, you know, what is the secret to wealth building? The secret to wealth building is spend less than you earn, right? It's that simple. What's the formula for being broke? Spend more than you earn. I mean, it's, you know, it's not rocket science, all right? So with the foreign sector, what we're saying here is that if we sell more than we buy, we have a positive flow of money coming into the country. We call it a positive balance of payments, and the country it will grow. But if we buy from foreigners more than we sell from foreigners, more money leaves the country than enters the country, and eventually we get more unemployment and less growth. That's why, as I explained earlier, that's why countries want the value of their currencies to go down. Because when their value of their currency is low, foreigners buy more and money comes into the country. And that's what we need for economic growth. Okay, with a high-value currency, see, now, what's happened to the American dollar lately, or generally speaking, over the past year or so? Well, the American dollar has gone up in value for different reasons. Now, in a short run, what does that mean? Well, in a short run, what that means is that when you and I go shopping, like at Walmart, we can buy more, right? Why? Because when the American dollar goes up, that means foreign products become less expensive to us. So when we buy televisions, computers, and you know, all that stuff, we get bigger bang for a buck. It's you know, our buying power goes up. And you might say, well, isn't that a good thing? It's a good thing in the short run, but in the longer run, it's a bad thing. See, it's a bad thing in the long run because when we buy, you know, when the value of the dollar goes up, and as consequence, we buy more from foreigners, you see, money leaves the country, then more money leaves and comes in, Eventually, what's going to happen? Well, it's just like a family. If a person spends more than their income, they may have a good time for a while, but eventually what happens?
Everything balances out.
Well, no, it doesn't balance out. It crashes. You go broke.
You get like a bell curve, and then you hit the peak, and then it just goes down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's what's happening to America right now. What's happening to America right now is that because of the high value of the dollar, we're buying things from foreigners at very low prices. But as long as this continues, see, it's all based on debt.
Is that why 4K TVs are getting really cheap?
Well, I don't know about the specifics, but it's a reason why our buying power is very good when we buy foreign products. It's one of the reasons why when you go to the store, a lot of what you buy is made in foreign countries. Well, one of the reasons for that is because of the high value dollar. But we're sowing the seeds of our own demise later on. It's the same thing as a person living a high life by borrowing money. It feels good in the short run, but over the longer run, it's a bad thing. And that's where we are right now, you know, as Americans. So, you know, one question might be, well, why is the dollar? Now, when I say high value, by the way, when I say high value, we're always talking about the value of one currency relative to the value of other countries' currencies. It's always a relative thing, all right? It's always a relative thing. It's not an absolute. It's not an absolute value. It's a relative value. So when we say the value is going up, and when we say the dollar is going up in value, that means that its buying power goes up relative to other currencies. Okay, that's important to know. So anyway, that's a bad thing. And later we're going to talk about, why is the American dollar has a high value? Well, there's several reasons for it. I'm not going to go into that now. I mean, I can't. You know, that's in a future chapter.
Does sanctions have to do with anything in the last year or so with the sanctions over Russia and whatnot that increased the American dollar?
I'm not sure. I have to think about that, you know, in terms of sanctions.
Because we put a lot of sanctions over a lot of countries.
Yeah.
Essentially, but decreasing their values of their...
Well, I... Yeah,
it
but...
It has to do with, the petrodollar thing.
Well, the petrodollar. Well, that's... Now you're... Yeah, yeah. You know, Dimitri mentioned the petrodollar, which is something we talk about later. I mean, one of the reasons, well, the two big reasons why there's a high value dollar is that, number one, the dollar is the world standard currency, and number two, because of the petrodollar system. And the petrodollar system is where we made an arrangement years ago with Saudi Arabia, and we said to Saudi Arabia, we'll protect you militarily if you promise that when you sell your oil, you will only accept payments in American dollars. And then other oil-producing countries did the same thing, and that's called the petrodollar system.
Except for Saddam Hussein, right?
Well, I don't know.
Whatever, Iraq.
I don't know.
And that's why we invaded them?
Well, let's not get into that. but that's what's called the, and so that, but these are things we'll talk about later. I mean, you know, I can't talk about everything all at once. So let's stay with the program here. Is the foreign sector a stabilizing or a destabilizing force? Both. It can stabilize the economy if foreign demand remains high in a declining economy, destabilizing the foreign markets decline. In other words, if we don't trade with other nations, then when demand goes down, I mean, you know, when Americans spend less on American products, then that's going to make a big difference. That's going to hurt our economy. You know, you're going to get a lot more unemployment. But if we trade with other nations, okay, it's possible that Americans will buy less. But if foreigners continue to buy from American companies, that's a cushion. See, demand for American products don't fall as much now because the foreign sector is helping us out, and that prevents unemployment from getting bad as quickly as it would otherwise. So that's an example of the foreign sector being a stabilizing force. But the foreign sector can also be a destabilizing force. It can be a destabilizing force because if a lot of the demand is foreign demand, and foreigners experience economic difficulties and they buy less from us, then regardless of what we do, we experience more unemployment. So, I mean, even though the American consumer may continue to buy just as much, the foreign sector, if it's very important, it'll have a big impact and cause unemployment. You know, this has happened. England experiences this a lot, you know, in the past. England has been a country that has been very dependent upon exports. But when foreign demand, when the rest of the world goes into recession, then countries who are dependent upon foreign demand are affected a lot more than countries that are not so dependent upon foreign demand. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what you mean by 100% consumer base because, we've got government, you know, spending, and we've got investment spending. I mean, you can't have just consumers. You got to have someone producing things that consumers buy, and you're always going to have government. So you're always going to have the foreign sector. Almost every country trades with other countries. See, what is the characteristic for the government sector? The U.S. is a democracy in a republic. A democracy is ruled by the majority votes. A republic is ruled by law. See, you know, when we say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, you know, we say, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. It doesn't say for the democracy for which it stands. See, our forefathers made us a republic, not necessarily a democracy. There's a big difference. See, in a democracy, who rules? Well, in a democracy, the majority rules, correct? Now, what is the danger? In fact, our people who started this nation with, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton and people like that, I mean, they warned us against the dangers of democracy. See, what is the danger in a democracy? Well, the danger in a democracy is that the majority can take everything away from the minority. Right? I mean, whoever gets the majority of votes, they've got the power to take everything away from the minority if they choose to do so. Right? That's how a democracy works. But what is a republic? Well, a republic is a system based on law. And what is the one of the main purposes of those laws. Well, one of the main purposes of those laws is to protect the minority from the majority. See, that's what our Constitution's all about. Our Constitution is aimed at protecting the minority from the majority. Our Constitution is to protect us from democracy. See, the Constitution doesn't give us democracy. It protects us from democracy. Does that make sense? This may be a novel way of looking at it for some of you. But, see, we are a democracy in a republic. Now, look at this. If you have a lot of, look at my two hands here. If you have a lot of democracy, but not much republic, you know, the rule of law, then the majority can take advantage of the minority. But if you go in the other way and you have not much democracy, but you have a whole lot of republic, see, what was the name of the old Soviet Union? The USSR. United Soviet Socialist Republic. Well, where's that? There's that name, republic. Now, was the old Soviet USSR, did you have any democracy there? Well, no, it was a tyrannical government. It was, you know, ruled by just a very few. You know, the average person had almost, you know, no freedom at all. All right? So if you have a republic like you did maybe in the old USSR, you can have a republic, but if you don't have any democracy, then people don't have any opportunity to influence those laws. And therefore, those laws can be contrary to personal freedom. So what is the best system in this very imperfect world we live in? Well, the best system is to have a kind of like a balance. You know, you've got democracy where people influence the republic, but then you've got laws in terms of republic that protect the minority from the majority. And that's what we have in America. Now, over time, this thing shifts. Sometime, you know, the democracy becomes supersedes the republic, and sometime, you know, the republic supersedes the minority. But I mean, change is inevitable over time. Change, you know, we're always going to have change. But as long as we're tending toward a point where there's more or less a countervailing power between the republic and the democracy, then you know, we can, in this imperfect world, we can maximize our personal freedom and have prosperity.
Did you say too much rule of law is a bureaucracy?
Yeah. Now, the question was, can you call the rule of law too much bureaucracy? Is that what the bureaucracy? Yeah, I mean, bureaucracy is when you have a, you would say that, you know, you've got big government, so. You've got the rule of law there, but you've got you could have less democracy. So anyway, what is the danger in a pure democracy? The majority can take everything away from the minority. What is republic? A system based on law whereby the minority is protected from the majority. And what are the main ideas of the Declaration of Independence, 1776? Our rights come from God, and that liberty is fragile. I mean, if you click on this link, you get to the Constitution. But why, you know, why did they say that our rights, our liberties, come from God? Because if our liberties came from an institution or came from a group of people, what could that group of people do?
Change it.
They could change it. They could take our rights away. But if our rights come from God, then if we really believe that, can anybody take our rights away? No. And that's why if you read the Constitution, it says that, you know, Thomas Jefferson in his writings and Hamilton, you know, they said that, you know, our rights come from God, because they were very concerned with personal liberty.
Oh, so wait, does that mean, like, it's not necessarily implying, like, the belief in, like, you know, like, how religion and government can't, like, be together?
Well,
rather that, like...
Well, let's not get into religion. It's not really about religion. It's about... It's about the source of our, you know, what is the source? What is the source of our personal liberty?
So no, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, like, the reason they put God there is just to imply that, like, so no one can take our liberties away.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point.
Yeah. Not because
God is like a third person.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a triangle. You know, if you've got a straight line, I've never looked at it this way, but if you've got a straight line, you've got just two groups, then one group can take everything away from the other group. But if you've got a triangle, see, and so you say that our liberties don't come from this other group, but they come from a third source.
Then it
helps. Anyway, it's pretty deep, I guess, in terms of, and time is up. I don't want to get into all of this, but I just wanted to introduce you to some ideas that might give you some food for thought. But anyway, this does, finish this lecture. So we'll pick this up next time, okay? And we'll finish this chapter next time. So I'll see you all next time. Yeah.